The Roy Strong Diaries, 2004 to 2015. This is the third volume of Roy Strong's diaries covering the aforementioned years. In January 2004, Strong was in a state of deep grief following the death of his wife 3 months earlier. Yet the diaries, written in this first year following Julia's death, offer a picture of determination and resourcefulness as he begins the task of ordering Julia's huge collection of papers, antiques, and jewellery. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Sir Roy Strong himself. Sir Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Charles.
This is the third volume of your diaries, and a particularly delicate time you're covering.
Well, it is. It is how I made a new life. I mean, many of your listeners will have lost partners, and I've always had a motto in life: you must never forget, but only go forwards. I'm just about to do it here again. I'm leaving this house with its wonderful garden and everything because I'm 85 and it's all a bit too much. And I'm moving to a small market town, and I'm sure that's the right move. But again, it's looking forward and saying, well, when I go, however wonderful it was here, I must now look forward to make a different kind of life and a different sort of garden.
And it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because some people would say, well, you know, I've got to this stage. I can't change what I'm doing. I'll just remain what I'm doing. But your motto,
I think that's incredibly boring. Here I am. I've got a wonderful trainer who's now got me on to lift. I can now deadlift twice my own weight. Always believe in taking new things on as you get older. And he taught me when I was 77, because I couldn't jog anymore, I've tried to ride a bicycle. I never had one when I was a child, so of course you can't learn balance. So he discovered what a tricycle. So I've got this wonderful tricycle, and I go riding around Herefordshire. And you must not. And I find the very difficult thing is that people always assume once you're past a certain age, you mustn't exert yourself. I remember my parents, who virtually sat in a chair for 20 years in their old age. You must get up and move. And also, it's very important. I remember when I went for an annual checkup, my doctor always gave me messages, and he looked at me and he said, Roy, remember as you get older to surround yourself with younger people. By that, he didn't mean a row of nymphets. But there I was in my 70s then. It was really to have people in their late 40s and 50s. And now some of my greatest friends are in their 60s and 70s. Well, that's 15 or 20 years younger than me. Because you find the saddest thing, and you will see it in the diaries, every so often I write a reflective piece about someone who's died and gone. And it's very nice to know that you must really concentrate on making friends, if it happens, with people who are younger than yourself.
It's that, isn't it? It's that surrounding yourself and also always having something to look, you know, to go forward to. Otherwise, you become nostalgic and perhaps not in a healthy way.
Well, even in this marvellous house and garden, I've been here half a century, and then suddenly, and I've given it to Perennial, which is a great garden charity, and it'll open to the public and all the rest of it, and that's wonderful. But it does, one's emancipated by shedding things and going forward, and also towards the end, because I haven't yet moved, I'll move in about a fortnight's time. It's in a way you're kind of surrounded by your own shroud. And I say that with affection because my ashes will be buried here when eventually I pop off, God knows when. But I think it's incredibly important always to be optimistic. And this has been a difficult year for everybody, really awful, including me.
Indeed. And I mean, the period you cover, 2004 to 2015, also it seemed, as we came into this new century, I mean, we've seen changes in society and changes in the way that we communicate with each other, and the great institutions such as the galleries and the museums and the literary world communicate with each other.
When we entered into lockdown, I said nothing will be the same after this. And the world I knew, which is post-war, grammar school boy, scholarships everywhere, and coming up through the top, everything has now really been thrown to the four winds. And the world I left, the museums and galleries, will have to rethink itself. for a different society shattered by what has happened. And I think we apply that can be applied to absolutely everything. There's going to be a tremendous rethink of the nature of our society and where we're going and what the future will be about, which will be pretty tough, but it's good to have to ask those questions. While I fade away.
Well, you're not fading away just yet.
So. No, I'm dead, but I won't lie down.
So what is? I mean, let's look at some of the things that you cast your eye over, including, and it seems a world away now, but things like the London Olympics and that feeling of, because a lot of people were doomsaying and naysaying and saying the London Olympics was going to be a complete fiasco, but yes, it turned into one of the greatest affirmations of Great Britain.
Yes, it did, and it gave us all a lift when we needed it. And the sad thing is we need those lifts now, and it's difficult because a lift means that we all gather together and celebrate. Well, we can hardly gather together, at a safe distance, can we? So we need, when we come out of this, I think, some celebratory events where we are able again to pledge our love of our own country and our own aspirations and our own multicultural and very varied society and how it holds itself together, because otherwise we'll head into a very troubled period.
And also there have been various, shall we say, ruminations and difficulties within the royal family. And I'm just thinking, recently with the Sussex, etc. And I'm looking at the things like the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, for example, which again was an affirmation of what she has done for the country and how she has holding her importance in the national psyche.
Oh, well, I think she remains incredible, and it's interesting because it's very difficult to give messages to the nation and the rest of it through such a tempestuous period. And one must remember she's 94, which is a hell of an age. But on the occasions that she did it, she never got a word wrong. They were warm, they were dignified, they were perceptive, and had that little what I call common touch in them, which made one smile. Special lady, we're lucky.
So what do you think the future holds then for the institutions that you have been associated with? I mean, apart from the Guardian, which will come on to later, but the museums, the theatre, the arts. I mean, where do they go from now? What would if you were planning?
They're going to, by a degree, have to reinvent themselves in some way. Certainly, museums, vast tracts of the staff have been laid off on furlough. How much? All they'll be able to put all that staff back, I don't know. In the case of theatre, all it depends on is when they can open again. And also, of course, no government has ever put the arts at the, however important it is for bringing people together in a unity of enjoyment and delight, it would come very low down on their list, I would have thought.
But if you think about how people...
It'll be a very tough period. The other thing is that when I left museums, I lived through the period when government withdrew from museums. So I created the Friends, then the fundraising. And then in the end, by the time I resigned the V&A when I was 52, I was nothing but a fundraiser. And I thought, well, I hadn't come into museums for that. And then it went in that direction. And more and more and more, you see, with all the arts organizations, you go to the back of any catalogue or anything, it is all about one thing, money, 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 money. And then, and the idea of the state actually supporting our national institutions really has receded dramatically. And I think that will result in a very radical rethinking about the nature of any institution and the art that they purvey in relation to a wider society and the way they can go. Because I'm well aware that the structure and the interest of people two generations below me, and after all, I was brought up in the 1940s and 50s, which is a hell of a time ago, and everybody has moved on. I don't think moved on. It sounds so positive. I mean, their attitudes and their changes and their demands are very different from what I went through. So I think it's interesting to look on I'd be hopeless at it if I went back. I'd stir it up a bit, though.
And I mean, if you think about it, you know, the, through this period where we've been, you know, confined and locked down, and I mean, the arts, I mean, it's been very several times, but the art, people have been watching movies, they've been watching their series, they've been going on interactive tours of museums. I mean, the arts are the things that keep people sane.
Well, they kept people going, and also people read more.
Yeah. And I mean,
people read more.
And surely,
I mean, the experience of a picture on a lit up screen, and one, of course, is in front of me. It happens to have my cat on it, but there we are. I could have been looking at a Leonardo da Vinci. There's no substitute for the reality of performance or the reality of a work of art or the reality of a concert or something like that. Seeing it on screen, however well it's done, and aren't we lucky? A century ago, we couldn't have dreamed of anything like that. I mean, it is marvellous, but it is no substitute for the reality at all of performance and the interplay between a live audience and the people who are there, or just the physical presence of going around a gallery with other people, all sorts of things like that. But don't worry. I mean, they're very inventive, the museum people, and also the other people in the arts. And, of course, financially it will have hit them in an absolutely whopping way. I mean, I don't see how museums can really avoid not introducing some form of charge to go in. That started in 1970, and we are now half a century on, and the row still goes on.
It's interesting, isn't it, because there is... You know, we talk about we've been able to see these things on our screen, but there's something about that second before when the audience falls silent and the curtain comes up, or in a theatre they're at, as the first actor comes on stage, is that frisson of excitement, or actually turning around the corner and seeing, you know, a famous painting that you haven't seen before, or visiting an old friend again. I was in Madrid a couple of years ago, and the first thing I did, I went up to see the Guernica because I hadn't seen it for a while, and it's like greeting an old friend. And even though I've seen it before several times, it's still when you turn the corner and just go, wow, and you don't get on the internet.
Yes, you just reel back. And of course, the other thing it's going to affect is it's going to be more expensive to travel. I mean, I've always loved Italy since I first went there when I was about 20, I suppose. And it's not going to be so easy to move around because it's going to cost more.
Yeah. When you come to get your diaries ready for publication, I mean, is there you don't just sort of literally put them down as they were? I mean, there must be a fair amount of reviewing and re-editing. And what is it like to revisit that particular?
No, I don't keep a daily diary because I think that would be boring. And sometimes there are patches when I should have written. They are word for word exactly what I wrote, except where if I've used the same adjective. They are actually what I wrote. At the date is at the head, and that is when I wrote it, and it is unchanged. Otherwise, you're a complete fraud.
Right.
All my diaries go to the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and they've got all of them up to the original documents for the present. No, I mean I think it's absolutely dreadful if you rewrite your diaries. I don't.
Right.
What I liked about them, most of my friends, was somebody who was very nice, and he said, well, your diaries are so different because you actually describe what people look like and what they wear. I said, well, it always fascinates me, you know, that what somebody's hair is like, or that they put a jewel top right on their dress or something like that. I mean, I think it's putting people in their setting. I think it's interesting. All those things. I mean, those big... I mean, I had the honour to be an honorary figure at Westminster Abbey, so I was present and took part in all the great ceremonies for 20 years. And I always used to go back and literally within 24 hours would sit down and write an account.
Normally, you'd be going off on a book tour to promote this volume of your diaries. Are things a little
bit
different?
Well, I can tell you, I've done book tours again and again and again, and I think I have to face up, however fit I am and my train said to me, when I said, well, where have I got? And I said, how are we getting on? And he said, you are a very fit 75-year-old. Well, I'm 85.
Right.
I couldn't take what I used to do. I would go the length and breadth of the country. I did it for a book, which was really worried about what's going to be the big problem of this century. It's one I tried to contribute towards solving, the future of the parish churches. And after producing a book called A Little History of the English Country Church, to take this appalling problem out to a wide audience, I literally went from pulpit to pulpit all over the country. I ended up with pneumonia in hospital, and I thought, I can't actually do that again. I mustn't.
So what do you hope?
Well, there we are.
what do you hope that the people will take from your diaries? I mean, obviously, you said at the beginning of the interview, it's the fact that you must always be looking forward, and you must never forget the past, or but you mustn't dwell on it with melancholy or with rose-coloured spectacles.
I think people should come reading from those diaries as a sense of delight, a sense of hope. Yes, I think it's. I don't know. I mean, obviously, the newspapers go through them for whatever I write about the royal family. But actually, 99% of the book isn't about that at all. It's about, you know, how one single person makes a voyage into old age and into being a widower. I mean, that's an enormous bridge to cross of grief and feeling of desperation and loneliness, and how knowing that my late wife, who was a famous designer called Julia Trevelyan Oman, I always remember in those last weeks, she just looked at me and she said, and she was dying of pancreatic cancer, it was a terrible thing to go through, and she just looked at me and she said, but you have so much more to give. It was a wonderful thing to have said to me, but you have so much more to give. And that's what I do within the confines of my health and energy. I think that's fine. I'm very lucky. I've had an absolutely extraordinary life.
The book is called Types and Shadows, The Roy Strong Diaries, 2004 to 2015. It's published by Winefield and Nicholson. I've got to ask you, how is the garden looking today? Because we're going to be December tomorrow, so how is the garden looking?
Well, I love the garden in winter. The first time the Lascaux Gardens ever appeared was in a book by Rosemary Vere, a great garden writer, called The Garden in Winter. And there was, I planted a pleach lime avenue, and suddenly you see the beauty of the branches being trained. You see a kind of swagged hedge in beech underneath, which is now that wonderful shade of russet. You see the topiary in yew cut into different shapes. You've got to learn to look at a garden in a different way in winter, and then you see those little things like very early snowdrops and things begin to pop up. But a garden does look, and also the most wonderful thing you can ever get it is a hoarfrost. If you can get out into a marvelous garden with huge frost and mist. Oh, it's though you're in the middle of the Nutcracker Ballet.
Well, I saw my first robin the other day over here in Spain of the season, so I was like, yeah, okay, we're on the way. You know, as winter is coming, as the saying goes. The book is called Types and Shadows. It is the Roy Strong Diaries 2004 to 2015. And can I just say what a wonderful image that is of you in the front cover. I'm in deep envy of the waistcoat. Sir Roy Strong.
I've given it to the Fashion Museum in Bath.
Ah, right, so people can check that one out as well. Sir Roy Strong, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
You too. Thank you, Charles. Bye.